You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
It was the 40th anniversary of the day that Bastion Point protesters were evicted from the land that they had been occupying for more than 500 days in 1977 and 78. So it was a commemoration of that particular moment in time when the government under Robert Muldoon at the time had decided to take, shall we call it radical action? Take against people who'd been protesting the state's move on that piece of land up there.
And why were people protesting? What was the context to that occupation?
Well, it's got a long historical context. So the land was first taken from that particular block belonging to Ngāti Whātua or Rākei back in the 19th century, so taken for defence purposes. And it was a big piece of land, I think 700 acres, that they had clearly marked out as not available for sale, leasing, any kind of colonial encroachment. So they had, you know, it was a clearly marked out block that they wanted to reserve for themselves. And over the decades and years, it had been whittled away by various means, and the last pieces of land, I think, were taken under the Public Works Act, and that's the area down at Ōkahu Bay, which we, you know, Aucklanders get to enjoy whenever we please, where the papakāinga of Ngāti Whātua were, and their homes were burned down in the 1950s, and they moved up to the bastion up the hill towards where the marae is now. There was some land up there as well, which was, you know, there'd been some toing and froing about making it available for the marae, but ultimately the Muldoon government wanted to subdivide it and make it available for what probably would have been, you know, pretty expensive housing at the time. And that was, you know, the protest came really at the end of generations of Ngāti Whātua trying to get some redress around a range of land issues in their territory.
As you say, just because we had also the Ihu Mātou stand in the weekend, often the government seems to take Māori land and turn it into housing for everybody. Is that a common occurrence?
I would say it's a common occurrence. I think if we go back to some of the specific issues around the land march in 1975, one of the triggers was the taking of land for coastal land in the north, east of Whangarei. And although Māori by that stage owned a very small proportion of the land in the area that the state wanted to take for what they called Esplanade Reserve was actually mostly coming from Māori. So there's this kind of continual encroachment on Māori land, even at a time when Māori don't own that much land anymore. And that's, you know, that's kind of Ihu Mātou thing. That's pretty much the situation at Bastion, at Ōkahu, at Ōrākei. I think there's a sort of basic idea, I believe, that Māori land is public land, and I think historically the public has looked to Māori as to provide land for public purposes. So a lot of Māori land is taken for scenic reserves around the country, for example, taken for roading, taken for all kinds of purposes, and the interesting bit that I think people don't necessarily realise is that the rules around how to compensate Māori for their land if it was taken under public works were not the same as the rules for what we call general land, so, you know, basically non-Māori land. And Māori did not have to be compensated. They could be compensated, but the state wasn't obliged to compensate them unless it was ordered by the Māori Land Court.
So there's always different rules for Māori, sorry?
Yeah, different rules for Māori land and non-Māori land. And, you know, people hear that and, you know, think I'm misspeaking or I've got something wrong, but I haven't got anything wrong. That's how it was for most of the 20th century.
And that's sort of the basis of that rhetoric, iwi versus kiwi. What are the implications of that divide?
Well, I think the implications that Māori don't get a rest from handing our land over for the purposes of Pākehā settlement. So we think of that as something that happened in the 19th century, and it did happen in the 19th century, but it also continued to happen in the 20th century. And so even these days, so the Patricia Grace case for land that they wanted to take for road development, and she refused, and people think, you know, oh, the Māori just being obstructive, and why are they opposed to Grace, and, you know, this would be good for everybody. But this is how many generations of us have to keep giving under this idea of it's good for everybody. But, you know, we just keep giving and giving. Well, I'm saying giving, but, you know, the experience of it is that our stuff keeps getting taken and taken and taken for the public good. And I think Māori have got a good record on contributing to the public good. I mean, we've been pretty good at going off to war for this little country of ours. So we're not short on contributing to the public good, and yet we seem to have be called on again and again to contribute more and more and more, even as our resources are dwindling.
Like you said, in terms of Māori not getting a rest in regards to these issues, was the Bastion Point occupation a unique occurrence in terms of land grabs and resistance? That 1980s period was, I mean, there was a lot of unrest at that time, right?
Yeah, there was a lot of, I guess, Māori civil unrest at the time, a sort of explosion of consciousness around land issues and a strong land rights movement. I think that what happened at Bastion Point in terms of the issue being an intergenerational one, where generations of the iwi there had tried through the so-called proper channels to have the land issues righted, you know, that, and then the occupation comes and is viewed by the public as this incredibly radical exercise, but it comes at the end of a very long period of trying to get something done. And it happens because there aren't any options left. That's the only option. The bulldozers are about to move onto the land and start the development for subdivision. And the occupation seems to be the last option. And I don't think people go lightly into an occupation of more than a year to have a winter, actually nearly two winters up on the on an exposed block like that. You know, I don't think that's a move that people took lightly. So it's kind of, I think that particular occupation is a one of the iconic actions during that 1970s 1980s period. So it's an iconic land rights moment, but the source of the issue and the nature of the protest is something that we see elsewhere. I don't know how you would count up the number of land grievances around the country that have a similar kind of pattern to them,
but also still occurring today.
Yes, and even what's happening today, I think the roots of what's happening today, we can probably track them back into the 19th century a lot of the time.
What was the result of the Bastion Point occupation?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess, I mean, it took Ngāti Whātua a long time to get some practical results in terms of redress, and they ended up in front of the Waitangi Tribunal taking their claim. And so really the results for the public are are a result of the generosity of Ngāti Whātua. So, you know, they do native tree planting on some of the land up there. They open up their home, in a sense, their marae to Auckland, and have rebuilt, I suppose, their relationships with Auckland Council. They have a great Waitangi Day festival down at Ōkahu Bay, which is, you know, I think those are results that are available to the public that we get to enjoy. And I think that's one of the things that people perhaps don't appreciate about some of these projects, that actually sometimes sometimes things are better for all of us. So, you know, if we're getting back to the idea of public good, sometimes Māori understand what public good is in a Māori way. And if we thought about that land being subdivided, I don't think we'd have the access to it that Ngāti Whātua allows the public to have. I think it would be a very different thing. So I think that's a kind of a public result of the occupation. I hope that another result is that people are a bit more aware, and particularly that Aucklanders are a bit more aware of the, you know, how we get to live in this place, and how the transfer of land from Māori to Pākehā has been critical to establishing cities like Auckland. I hope that's a result as well.
What can people from Aotearoa learn from this?
Well, I hope that we can learn that Māori grievances about land are historical, that we didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, you know, started demanding our things back, that actually there's some, you know, really solid reasons that we have, for example, the Waitangi Tribunal inquiring into land grievances all around the country, because there are land grievances, and that they're intergenerational, and Māori have sort of understood at every generation what colonisation has done to us. I think that's something to learn. I've, you know, really pushed back against this idea that Māori are just making things up, you know, since the late 20th century because we're greedy. And, you know, I think that's an idea that really needs to be corrected. I hope that from it we can learn that sometimes the media is not the best way of representing what's going on in the Māori world. If you have a look at, you know, some of the print media around the Bastion Point occupation, for example, and, you know, later protests like the Foreshore and Seabed Hikoi, it's very, there's a lot of name-throwing that happens. The idea of, you know, Māori as haters and wreckers. The idea that each individual protest is just a flashpoint and nothing to worry about. And I hope that what we can learn is actually these things are interconnected, that there's a pattern of there's a pattern to the way that colonisation works, and that fundamental to it is that Māori or Indigenous land and resources get transferred to the colonising population. That's the, you know, that's colonisation. That's the project. Yeah, I just guess it's an opportunity, if we want it to be, to learn our history.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.